36. Dick About Theater. Broadway legend Elaine Stritch called me. "People say we're alike," she announced in her deep contralto voice. "I want you to come and play my kid." Elaine had been cast as the matriarch in Lillian Hellman's Watch on the Rhine. It was a big fundraiser for Stage West in Springfield, Massachusetts. She wanted me to play the female lead, her daughter, Sarah. I was flattered, but I turned the offer down. "Thank you, Elaine, but I don't know dick about theater." Elaine roared back, "I'll teach you theater!" Cagney and Lacey was over. I was taking a break from TV and TV movies. I told Barney about the opportunity. "Elaine Stritch is offering to teach you stage acting," Barney said. "How bad could that be?" As it turned out, pretty damn bad. I packed my trunk and headed off to Boston. I'd always thought that if I ever did theater, it would be a comedy like Same Time Next Year, not a drama about the rise of fascism before World War II. I was terrified that I was in way over my head. But I clung to the hope that Elaine Stritch would guide me through. Then Elaine quit the show. She walked out after the first week of rehearsals. I couldn't believe it. I drove around Springfield to every listed AA meeting I could find looking for her. She was very open and public about being an alcoholic, and I knew she attended meetings daily. I found her at the last one on the list. "We had dinner plans," I reminded her. "What is going on?"
"I'm leaving the show, kid," she told me. "The director doesn't know what he's doing."
It wasn't true. Eric Hill was a wonderful director who cared deeply about his theater. She wouldn't listen to him. She would decide that she could change the blocking, moving the child actors around on stage, all the while arguing why it should be her way. She disrupted the rehearsals. I knew it was mostly nerves. She was tearing at the cuticles of her fingers until they bled. If Elaine Stritch was anything, she was intuitive. I think she sensed that she was about to be canned. The director told me privately that he was one day away from letting her go. I couldn't feel sorry for her, though. She'd got me into this play. Now she was ditching me. I called Monique. She had no qualms about me packing my bags and catching the next flight to L.A. since the original agreement had changed. I didn't have to stay. But the theater had sold out the run and had already raised almost $1 million, based on our two names, to keep Stage West in business. I refused to abandon them with an expensive production. I stayed. Kim Hunter took over the Grand Dame role. She had won the Academy Award and Golden Globe for playing Stella in A Streetcar Named Desire, and had done all genres of acting, stage, big screen, and some television. She didn't try to teach me theater, but I still learned a lot from her. She had her lines down within days and fit into the production as if she had been there from day one. Mostly, she was so kind to me in my virgin voyage across the boards. It was never fun. There are no second takes in live theater. But I did it. The reviews were good. The audience was very respectful. Elaine went back to her beloved Broadway, and I saw her in Edward Albee's A Delicate Balance 6 years later. I went backstage to see her co-star Rosemary Harris, whom I knew well. Elaine shouted out from her dressing room, "Hey, kid! Are you going to walk past and not say hi?" No, I couldn't walk by. I couldn't even mention the past. That was the influence of Elaine Stritch. She had such a vulnerable presence, you couldn't stay mad at her. She was always contentious. She was difficult. Brilliant people can be. And most people who have worked with her would agree that she was a genius on stage. I respect that. I respected her. In an odd way, she did give me a great lesson. I stepped out of my comfort zone and tried my talent at theater. And I was rewarded with standing ovations. I know Watch on the Rhine wasn't a tour de force for me, but I had been given some grace to take a risk.
and I took it. And for once, the complaint wasn't about me. Star Maker. Near the end of the first season of The Trials of Rosie O'Neill, Monique James told me, "When you were young and starting out, I did you a great disservice. I wrapped you in cotton wool. I only told you about the people who liked you, the ones who thought you were a knockout. I never told you about the people who didn't like you and didn't want to cast you or work with you." Clearly, she was trying to hurt me. And she was successful. She was feeling unappreciated by me, even though I knew how much I needed her. I had never learned how to manage the business side of my career. Monique took care of everything for me. I could always leave any problem, professional but sometimes also personal, to her to handle so I could put my entire focus into my performances. Now, nearly 10 years after leaving Universal Studios, Monique's influence with producers and the television industry had waned. She could also tell that Barney's opinion of my work held sway for me. Throughout her entire career, everyone always listened to what Monique James had to say, except Barney. When Cagney and Lacey ended, I think Monique had hoped to be done dealing with Barney Rosenzweig and his influence over me. But that didn't happen. In 1990, Jeff Sagansky, the CBS president at the time, had given Barney an open door and a financial guarantee to produce a one-hour drama with me as the lead. Barney created The Trials of Rosie O'Neill, in which I played a Beverly Hills attorney who gets dumped and taken to the cleaners by her ex-husband. She sets up her humble desk as a Los Angeles City Court public defender. The show opened each week with Rosie in her psychiatrist's office talking about her life. Carole King wrote the theme song, and Melissa Manchester recorded it. I won my second Golden Globe Award and received my 7th and 8th Emmy nominations for this show. Many talented actors and actresses appeared on the show with me. Tyne Daly, Ed Asner, Helen Hunt, Brenda Vaccaro, Meg Foster, and my dear friend Robert Wagner. RJ agreed to a guest star appearance for 3 episodes as my new love interest. I was nervous kissing him after having played his young assistant on Switch. When it came time to shoot that scene, I was on the set alone. When I asked where RJ was, the director told me that he had gone to his trailer to shave. It was late in the day, and he said he didn't want to scratch my skin with his 5 o'clock shadow. What a guy! And kissing RJ with or without whiskers was kind of wonderful. He always knew what he was doing on camera, including covering an actress's neck with his hand when he kissed her. He protected her from the close-up camera capturing the creases. You could love a guy like that. And I do. Very much. Monique would come to the set of Rosie O'Neill and give Barney feedback about the show and my character. It wasn't well received. Barney and Monique would argue over something concerning me almost every day. Barney would want it to be one way, Monique would want it to be the complete opposite. They would have it out with one another and walk away, often angry. I would be the one who paid the emotional price, the pawn in the middle. I couldn't agree with one without hurting the other. I was constantly torn between the two most influential people in my life. I was now in a serious relationship with Barney, who was once again my boss, but I had trusted and relied on Monique as my mentor for over 20 years. One day, Monique asked me to come to her house. She was sitting in her bed with the open New York Times and a full ashtray. She looked exhausted and sad. "I think I'd like to call it a day. This is clearly no longer working well. It's too difficult now." She was breaking it off with me. I was in shock. I had trusted her judgment implicitly because she always told me the right thing to do. She couldn't possibly be serious, I thought, sitting in stunned silence next to her bed. Monique had an ironclad will. cushioned by a great sense of humor. But there was no magical thinking when it came to the entertainment industry. She fearlessly faced the reality of the business, and to her, the reality was that our relationship had run its course. I didn't know how to move forward without her. From the beginning, the day Monique signed me as a universal contract player, her goal had always been to keep me working. She sure as hell did. Over our time together, she would get word to me, no matter where I was, to make sure I knew about opportunities being offered, even having me paged at the packed Orange County Fair. This was before cell phones. She once got a call through to me on a cruise ship, which was no easy feat in the early 1980s. She had a made-for-TV movie offer for me and needed an answer before the ship would dock. The script was the story of three female astronauts in training, each vying to be the first U.S. woman to travel to outer space. The script was pretty cheesy, but they were offering great money. Monique gave me some sage advice. There are times in our career when we do a project not because it's great, but because it puts us in a different income bracket. This is one of those times. I couldn't argue with that. I took the large check. Monique came through professionally for me every time, without question. Thought about the day she invited me to lunch in the executive commissary at Universal Studios. There, on the wall, was an enormous backlit publicity photo of me in what she called my signature look, trousers and an open sweater, my hands in my pockets, and smiling with that thing I do with my mouth that she tried to discourage for years. She had it prominently placed among the photos of the biggest stars at Universal Studios, where every important entertainment executive would see it. Having my photo on the wall meant that I was a significant player in their wheelhouse of stars. It took me 10 years to get up there. Monique wanted to surprise me with it. She did. For me, that photo was better than winning an award. And now, she was done with me. I couldn't imagine not having Monique as my manager, advisor, confidant, and closest friend. I was devastated. I drove home to my Malibu Beach house that Monique had helped me decide to buy. Everywhere I turned was a reminder of her influence in my life. To go from a relationship in which I told her everything to having her now merely be a part of my history was awful. Felt like a piece of my heart had shut down, never to be recovered. And I believe from the bottom of my heart that her pain was equal to mine. Even though she was no longer representing me professionally, we couldn't stay away from one another. In the months that followed, Monique and I would get together for lunch or dinner every so often, but there was a delicate wedge between us that remained. One day, she called me to her home for a private conversation. She had cancer. It occurs to me now that she'd known she had cancer when she fired me. I knew it was serious. She was in bed. I could see she was weak. She asked me to close the door and sit next to her. She told me she loved me. The last thing she said to me was, "You be a good girl, sweet pea." I was living in Toronto in 2001, shooting Queer as Folk, when I got a phone call from Monique's grown daughter, Pammy, a.k.a. Sweet Potato. "Sweet pea, Mommy died today." I'm not sure if I spoke in response. For the first time in years, I shut down completely. I went numb. When I told Barney over the phone that Monique had passed away from cancer, he tried to console me, but his words of comfort were pointless to me. I yelled at him, "I never had the nerve to tell you both that the two of you always ruined it for me with your constant fighting. You were both awful, and the only person either of you hurt was me." Barney felt terrible about it. He apologized. It didn't help. I missed my friend and mentor.
I didn't grieve for Monique when she died. I had cried countless tears in the previous years. Her obituary noted her place in entertainment history as one of the 20th century's best-known and most successful talent agents. They called her the Star Maker. Everything I am and have today traces back to her. I'll say it forever. Thank you. I love you, Miss James. Thirty-eight. I do. We did. Twice. It was Pearl Harbor Day. Barney and I sat in a corner booth in Dan Tanna's restaurant. We had plans to vacation together in Hawaii for Christmas during our upcoming hiatus from the trials of Rosie O'Neill. My relationship with Barney had been both controversial in the public eye and personally fragile for over 2 years. Finally, the turmoil of our past seemed over. Things felt gentle, sweet. After his martini arrived, Barney leaned toward me. I need to tell you something. Oh, my God. After all this, he's got cancer? His eyes were teary. I was so frightened. I want to marry you, he said. What? I want to marry you. Oh, my God. I thought you were going to tell me you were terminal. You just scared the shit out of me. Barney seemed unfazed. I was freaked out. I had secretly wanted him to ask me to marry him, but I had never actually thought about how I'd answer if he got around to it. My mind was racing. I finally replied, "Can I get back to you on that?" He didn't even flinch. He calmly said, "Take all the time you need." It was a serious contemplation. To be or not to be a wife. I needed time. I called my mother the morning after Barney's marriage proposal. She now lived by herself in her Comstock cottage in Carmel and dedicated her time to doing bookkeeping for a priest. Although it was 5 in the morning, I knew she'd be up and getting ready for Mass at the mission. She was always the first one there. My driver had picked me up in Malibu and was heading to the studio. I was a mess. I was crying as she answered the phone. "Bug, what's the matter?" Her tone always soothed me. "Barney asked me to marry him," I sobbed. My mother said, "Well, that's wonderful, Bug. Isn't that what you wanted?" "No," I cried, "it'll ruin everything." Without pause, she said, "I understand, darling. You certainly have had no role models of a happy marriage." Even if I had witnessed happy marriages, I still wasn't sure marriage was for me. I felt like I was always changing and growing. I worried about waking up one day and thinking, "Who's that next to me?" In the makeup trailer, they put ice on my face to take down the swelling from crying. I'm sure they thought I had suffered some personal tragedy and not a loving proposal. 1 week later, Barney and I went for a walk on the beach in Malibu. We crossed paths with Gary David Goldberg, the writer and creator of Family Ties. He had been with the same woman, Diana, for decades. Even they had decided to finally get married. A few minutes after we passed Gary and Diana, I said to Barney, "I don't want to wait as long as they did." That's all I said. That's how I accepted his proposal. He was so happy. I was so hopeful and so full of trepidation. A while later, Barney and I went to Carmel to spend a weekend with my mother. The guest room had 2 twin beds. My mother, in her proper manner, informed Barney and me of the house rules. "Barney may stay with you in the guest room, but only if you leave the bedroom door open." Premarital sex was not welcome in her home. When she went to bed, she left her door open, too. Barney was amused and turned on by the challenge of making love to me without either of us emitting a sound, while my very Catholic mother slept across the hall.
sex without sin is like an egg without salt, he always told me. I understood exactly what he meant, but it also gave me pause, since we no longer needed to meet up secretly in hotel rooms in the middle of the day. Would the intrigue be gone? I wasn't sure I could keep it interesting, week after week, and 24/7, without some kind of taboo restriction. Barney knew he wasn't marrying a woman who was a homemaker kind of wife. There would be no French toast for breakfast unless he made it. I didn't own an apron, though I did collect cookbooks. I had hundreds of them. I spent hours reading delectable recipes. That's all I did. Read them. My pots and pans remain in mint condition. Barney knew all this. He still wanted to marry me. I wanted to marry him, too. We made plans. Two sets of plans. Barney and I were married at my Malibu beach house, out on the dunes, twice, in 1 week. Our legal wedding day was on May 1, although for a long time only 5 people in the world knew it. I wanted it to be private. My wish was to say my personal vows to Barney. We needed witnesses, so we asked my brother Michael and my cousin Lizzie. May 1 was a Wednesday. I chose high noon. 3 p.m. might have been a better choice because at 10 a.m. I was upstairs barefoot, wearing only a terry cloth robe and sitting at an old electric typewriter, pecking out my personal vows. That's where my cousin Lizzie found me. A cigarette dangling from my mouth and looking with bewilderment at a few typed pages covered in ashes, markings of crossed-out words, scratched-out quotes, and arrows drawn from the end of one sentence to the next readable one. Lizzie helped me cut and paste it all into something coherent. I wore a finely pleated satin skirt, a cashmere sweater cut on the bias, and a sloping brimmed hat, all in ivory. I had commissioned the head designer at the Ice Capades to make my real wedding dress, my repeat wedding dress, and a fallaway satin honeymoon nightgown. Michael walked me out onto the dunes for the intimate ceremony and then stood in as Barney's best man. Lizzie was my maid of honor. Naomi Carroll, a personal friend, was our minister. I read my prepared vows to Barney. He had prepared nothing. He winged it. Barney is good on his feet, and he knows it. I had a post-ceremony surprise for Barney ready to go. We had planned to have a wedding luncheon for the 5 of us on one of the patios of Joffrey's restaurant overlooking the Pacific. I had prearranged a small plane skywriter to spell out, "I love you, Barney," across the clear blue afternoon sky. I could hear the buzz of the plane engine doing its thing, so I told Barney, Michael, and Lizzie, "Come over to the railing with me. Look up." I was so excited. Unfortunately, there was a hefty ocean breeze that day, so the skywriter had to settle for a heart instead of the word love, and the letter U instead of the word U. And the wind had blown most of the letters lopsided. By the time he had chased the letters to spell out Barney, the E and the Y were over Burbank, about 13 miles away as the crow flies. Still, I thought Barney would be so smitten, seeing his name across the sky over Los Angeles. I could tell Barney loved it, but his sharp wit won out over any sense of romance. He shook his head at the sky and said, "Wow, that barber just doesn't give up." Our second wedding day was on May 4, a Saturday. We did a dress rehearsal at my house the night before, followed by dinner at a restaurant. The wedding party arrived at my house in a celebratory mood and had a cocktail, and then another, then again one or two more. Before we could rehearse, everyone was smashed, except for Barney's brother Joel and me. Our wedding coordinator, who had been hired to organize and direct the rehearsal, was useless. By the time we got to the restaurant, the group had sobered somewhat. On my chair, I found a baby blue Tiffany box. Inside was a sterling silver frame
with a photo of Michael and me as children. I looked down the table at my older brother, who was sitting at the opposite end. He was smiling with a look that said, "No one would ever come between us." When he toasted me at dinner, he lifted his glass and said, "To the first girl I ever loved." May 4 had all the potential of being a perfect day. The weather was mild. Large canopies had been set up to hide the ceremony from the paparazzi flying overhead in helicopters, hoping for the first photo. Small white twinkle lights resembling stars lined the undersides of the large tents. The dunes had been raked, and all of the chairs were in place for the attendees. The caterers were arriving with 6 pounds of Russian caviar and a spectacular menu. About 3 p.m., after handling a lot of details, I went to take my bath. There was a gentle tap at the bathroom door, and I heard my mother ask if she could come in. She stepped into the bathroom with a small stool and put it right next to the tub and sat down. She didn't say anything. She took the soap and washed my back. I was so touched by her gesture. I knew it was a small, loving ritual for my mother, preparing her daughter for her wedding night. It was the calmest 5 minutes of the entire day. My second wedding dress had been designed to be an exact replica of the dress that Katharine Hepburn wears on her wedding rehearsal night in the Philadelphia Story. The designer watched and paused the film dozens of times so he could match the look of the dress and the sparkle from the thousands of beads that made up the midriff of the gown. I had 3 silk men's suits in pastel colors made for Barney's adult daughters, Erica, Alin, and Tori. His girls were his best men for this ceremony. Alin's then 5-year-old daughter, Haley, was our little flower girl. Her dress alone was the cost of a house payment, but I spared no expense to have it all be perfect. Judith Ann was my maid of honor. Starting with that decision, the day became a fiasco. Judith Ann showed up, stormed up the stairs, and announced that the valet Parkers had refused to take her car. I threw on a bathrobe and went down the stairs barefoot and to the driveway where all the valet attendants waited. "Judith Ann is my maid of honor. Could you please take her fucking car?" Judith Ann was an emotional wreck. She had skipped my bachelorette party because she was in a bad mood, which seemed to be carrying over. It's a good thing that I loved her so much, because on the day she should have been helping me, she couldn't even manage to get her earrings through the holes in her earlobes. Her hands were shaking. I had to do that, too. I had bought my mother a beautiful pink suit with silk heels dyed to match, and had her hair and nails done. She was very pleased with it all. Just before the ceremony, though, she asked my permission to wear her pink bedroom slippers with the outfit because her feet hurt. I said, "Mom, couldn't you at least walk down the aisle in your heels? Eric will escort you. Then at the reception, you could put your slippers on." She said, "All right, Bug." As she limped away from me, I caved in. "Okay, Mom, you can wear the slippers." What else could I do? As always, she remained as poised and proper as ever, even though she had been sipping since lunch. Barney, who arrived dressed and ready, had no private groom quarters at my house where he could be alone. Not by choice, he ended up having to play host to the arriving guests while I continued to get ready. After an hour, Carol Smith appeared at my bedroom door. "Barney said to tell you, let's get this show on the road." "Are you kidding?" I responded. "No," she said. Obviously, Barney was wearing his producer's cap and was anxious to get started. I took one final look in the mirror and headed down the stairs. Judith Ann had preceded me and was barking at the wedding coordinator for forgetting to send our little flower girl down the aisle. We saw all of this on our wedding video later. It included footage of the hapless wedding coordinator gesturing frantically to our guests to rise to their feet as I approached the center aisle.
The paparazzi helicopters that had hovered over my house lowered down to the opening of the tent. A photographer was dropped down on a wire. My hairdresser ran to the tent opening and stood with his middle finger extended to block the photographer's view. I watched, thinking, okay, well, that's going to be the wedding photo for the press. My wedding cake had collapsed in a van with no air conditioning while it was being driven up the Pacific Coast Highway from Redondo Beach. It looked like one of those grade school volcano science projects. As awful as the wedding band was, the female singer who performed All I Ask of You from Phantom of the Opera for our first dance as bride and groom was even worse. She could not remember the words to the song or stay on key. It was so unbelievable that Barney and I just started laughing. The next morning at the wedding breakfast at the Bel Air Hotel, Judith Ann proclaimed loudly to Barney, "When you married Sharon, you married me." "My wildest fantasy realized," Barney answered dryly. I'm sure he didn't envisage exactly to what degree Judith Ann would consider herself our extra spouse. Barney had planned her honeymoon to end in a palatial Palm Beach house right on the Atlantic Ocean. We both were ready to relax and have some alone time with the balmy sea breeze as our only company. As it turned out, Judith Ann blew into town for business meetings and thought it would be just fine since we had such a large rental house to bunk with us to save herself hotel costs. Again, I was too afraid to say no. I loved her. I didn't want to hurt her feelings. Instead, I got a 3-day migraine. I couldn't have guessed then that our wedding week was the template of our now 30-year marriage. Hope-filled and heated, charmed and very challenging, angry, unpredictable, lonely, exasperating, and enlightening. We've laughed a lot, sometimes out of desperation, but most often because we are both pretty damn hilarious when we want to be. Thirty-nine. How would you like to be me? If I had taken photos, I could have published a coffee table book of Dairy Queens across the United States in the early 1990s. Northeast to southeast, southeast to southwest, I had been a happy customer at most of them. My newlywed spouse and I took a couple of long, long road trips together. The first one was an extended honeymoon from New England down to Florida. The second road trip was from Florida to Los Angeles. Barney loves to drive. I prefer flying. I'd rather watch movies than the road. But I do enjoy looking out the car window for Dairy Queens. We traveled countless back roads through small towns. Barney likes all things historical and quaint. I like all things cold and creamy. We put about 4,750 miles on the odometer and about 13 pounds each on our bodies. Barney has a fascination with early American cemeteries and headstones from hundreds of years ago. He would improvise an elaborate story based on a family grouping of headstones from the early 1800s. It was fun. Twice. After that, not so much. Close to our one-year anniversary, while Barney and I were vacationing in Palm Beach, he got a call with the news that CBS was canceling the trials of Rosie O'Neill. It wasn't totally unexpected. The executives have changed our time slot 6 times in our 2 seasons. We would start to pick up viewers, and CBS would move it to a different night and time. Despite my earning 2 Emmy nominations and a Golden Globe Award, if the viewers can't find the show, then eventually there will be no show to find. Suddenly, I was a non-working actress married to an executive producer without a show. Living in Los Angeles, where keeping a foot in the entertainment door is crucial to future success. Marriage is number 7 on the Holmes and Rahe scale of stressful events. Losing a job is number 8. Retirement is number 10. neither one of us was ready to get to number 10. One afternoon, I walked into the den to find Barney with tears streaming down his face. He'd been on the phone with his mother and learned that her breast cancer had metastasized into her brain, a fatal diagnosis. I asked him how best I could support him. He said, "Please stop smoking. Please. I went through so much to get you. I don't want to lose you." Barney had quit his cigarette and cigar-smoking cold turkey on his 50th birthday, during the final season of Cagney and Lacey. I had already given up drinking. I couldn't give up smoking. It was my strongest addiction, I thought. "You ask too much," I said. I walked out of the room. I had been reading a book about the 7 components of love, and one of them was making your loved one feel safe. I thought, okay, got it. My smoking isn't allowing him to feel safe. If I really love him, I have to stop frightening him. We decided we would both go to fat farms to lose some weight. He went to one in California, and I went to another in South Carolina. While I was there, I decided to quit smoking. My spouse had a complaint. I was going to fix it. It's a big mistake to quit doing anything for someone else. It's a hefty plate of pressure with a side order of resentment. It wasn't Barney's fault, but he was on the receiving end of my withdrawal symptoms and the simultaneous onset of full-blown menopause. He didn't know what had hit him. I was kidnapped by runaway hormones and felt isolated and confused. I didn't have an acting job to escape to. I didn't have any cigarettes. There was no martini at the end of the day. I would pace the floor all night long and be exhausted all day. I would feel like the walls of the room were shaking around me. I would lose my car keys, my house key, my wallet, and anything not surgically attached to me. One day, in complete frustration over my misplacing something important, Barney yelled, "You're driving me crazy!" Incredulous, I shouted, "How would you like to be me?" Barney said, "You're right. That has to be worse." When we were in public, I would make light of it, introducing him as my first husband. Barney would follow up with, "And this is my last wife, please God." I was no longer his Cagney or Rosie O'Neill. When I was his actress, he would stop what he was doing to pay attention to my ideas or my complaints. I was queen. The role of wife wasn't the same at all. If I went into his den, he would most likely respond, "Sharon, I'm working. I will talk to you at the end of the day." Then, a letter inviting me to star in a West End play in London showed up in the mail. The offer was to play Annie Wilkes in the stage production of Misery. There had already been the film adaptation of Stephen King's best-selling book in 1990 with Kathy Bates as Annie. Stephen King said that he had always envisioned Misery as a two-hander on stage. London playwright Simon Moore decided to make it as close to the book as possible, which was much, much darker than the movie. I thought, why not? I was raging through menopause. Why not put it all into a character on stage? I took the letter into Barney's den and announced, "I don't like the way you treat me. I just received an offer to start a play in London. I'm going to accept." Barney didn't put up an argument. He's a feminist. He wasn't about to tell me I couldn't go. I accepted the role and was instantly terrified by the commitment. I was about to star in the West End. The West End! London's Broadway on steroids, where I would be one of 2 people carrying the show. Dame Maggie Smith, Sir Derek Jacobi, Sir Ian McKellen, Sir John Gielgud, and Dame Judi Dench were all stars on West End stages. Their names made me breathless. Had my erratic hormones distracted me from what was realistic? As soon as I received the script, I had to start learning my lines. It was a 2-person play, so I had a lot to memorize. I wanted to have my lines down before I left for the London rehearsals, but menopause made concentration almost impossible. Worse yet,
Days after the script arrived, there was a huge earthquake near Los Angeles. I kept feeling massive aftershocks day after day. The floors and the walls were shaking and my heart would race. No one else seemed to be reacting to them. I couldn't understand it. My therapist wanted to send me to a psychopharmacologist. Barney insisted on going with me because he wanted the doctor to know what's going on in our house. As Barney was telling the doctor about my recent behavior changes, mood swings, trouble sleeping, and daily crying jags, the office walls started shaking violently. The chair I was sitting in was bouncing up and down. Excited to prove my point, I said, "See, it's all shaking. I'm not crazy. It's all shaking." Barney and the doctor exchanged long, knowing glances. "Well, lock me up then," I shouted. I started to cry. This violent shaking couldn't possibly be coming from within. But apparently it was. The doctor said, "Sharon, you need some antidepressants." I refused. "I don't want to take them. I'm going to London to do a play. I can't star in the West End and be on medication." The next day, I called the doctor in a panic. "I'm trying to memorize my dialogue for this play. I can't remember these lines." "Sharon, you need to take the pills," was his calm reply. "Take the pills, and you will remember the lines." He was right. My going to London was probably the best way to save our floundering marriage. I had to throw myself into the part of Annie full time, and Barney could be free from emotional turmoil for a while. I packed my trunk and went off to live in a little house in Chelsea provided by the theater. This play was going to be an intense experience. I knew Annie was not to be played as only a demented torturer. She actually believes she's having a relationship with her imprisoned writer, as sick as it is. She is aware that her mental illness is getting worse and worse, but she is incapable of regulating herself. She is in love with him. Annie needs to be plump due to her obsession with consuming fast foods. One of the producers, Andrew Welsh, told me, "Of course we will build you a fat suit." I said, "You don't have to do that. I can get there myself." I was in menopause and had already gained about 7 pounds from not smoking. I was miserable without cigarettes and I couldn't wait to just eat whatever I wanted. I denied myself nothing. I'd send my assistant, Sarah Channon, out for pints of ice cream and popcorn with butter, all of which I would eat every night in bed. Needless to say, over the course of rehearsal, I gained a lot of weight. While I was in early rehearsals, I went to see the stage production of Kiss of the Spider Woman. The week before, I had presented an award to Cheetah Rivera, the star of the London production, at a large theater awards show in London. I'm very shy, and I really almost chickened out on going backstage to say hello. But then I thought about it. She was an American actress, too. We were both far from home. I said, "Cheetah, I'm sure you don't remember me. I'm Sharon Gless. I presented your award to you last week." She said, "Of course I remember you. Do you know anybody here in London?" I said, "No." She said, "Well, I don't either. You want to have dinner sometime?" Cheetah rallied two famous English-born actresses, Rosemary Harris and Maureen Lipman, to join us. Rosemary is a phenomenal stage and film actress. American viewers probably know her best as Aunt May in all three of the Spider-Man movies. Maureen is a well-known face on British stage, television, and film, and an amazing comedian. She has now been knighted a dame. She calls herself Dame Mo. For 3 months, we all had dinner together once a week. The three of them had a natural back and forth that was so fast and witty that whatever they said would make me howl with laughter. I was in heaven. Cheetah kept telling me to cheer up. Toward the end of the rehearsal period, I looked the part of Annie. My hair was dyed a medium brown for the role, and I had to go out to buy men's corduroy pants and oversized sweaters to wear, as nothing I brought with me fit anymore with the weight gain.
I was still enjoying my carefree indulging. Maybe too much. One Sunday evening, producer Andrew Welsh invited me to a homemade dinner with his wife Emma and their two young sons. When I arrived, there was a cheese and grape board sitting on top of the bar. As we chatted, I helped myself to the wonderful cheeses. No one else ate any. I didn't mind that. I enjoyed almost the whole plate. At the end of dinner and eating everything offered, I jokingly said, "Okay, what's for dessert?" The boys dropped their eyes down to their laps, and Emma turned to look at Andrew with a desperate expression. Andrew cleared his throat and said gently, "Well, you already ate it." I had completely forgotten that the British often serve a cheese board at the end of a meal. Fortunately, they all thought it was funny. I could have died. The extra pounds I was carrying didn't bother me. The only thing I noticed was the fact that no one gave me more than a passing glance. I walked around London completely unrecognizable. One morning, when I arrived for rehearsal, I heard laughter from the back of the theater as I walked out on stage. "Well, you did it! Unbelievable!" roared the playwright director Simon. He was referring to my size. I played the part for 3 months, which is what my co-star Bill Patterson had agreed to when he signed on. Bill is Scottish and works nonstop in British film, television, and stage. He played the long-suffering dad on TV's multi-Emmy-winning Fleabag. He is a dream to work with and has become one of my dearest friends. On stage, Misery was undeniably violent, much rougher than the film. The play got good reviews and sold out every weekend, which was impressive considering it was not typical West End fare. The audience would nervously laugh at first and then gasp at the violence, and in anticipation of what Annie would do next to control and manipulate Paul. One woman fainted in her seat during the scene where Annie amputates her kidnapped rider's foot with an axe. Firemen took her out on a gurney. Believe it or not, her husband refused to leave. He wanted to see the rest of the play. During another performance, the prosthetic foot flew out into the audience. The audience always emitted muffled screams at this point in the play, but this night one scream was blood-curdling. It came from the person who got the severed foot in her lap. Audience members would wait at the stage door for Bill and me after the show. Bill would duck out. I basked in it all. The only person who wasn't happy with my performance as Annie was Barney. He flew in the night we opened and went straight to the theater from the airport to catch the show. I think he was shell-shocked. His blonde bride had now turned into a drab-haired, fat-as-hell, insane nurse. He was more than a little upset. I defended myself. Robert De Niro gained 60 pounds for Raging Bull, and everyone applauded him for doing that for his craft. "Well, I don't know what Mrs. De Niro had to say," Barney replied, "but I'm not a happy camper." Almost every journalist who interviewed me also focused on my weight. They seemed aghast that I would let myself go to such an extreme. I had by now put on 40 pounds. Concurrently, under the subject heading of ghastly extremes, my treasured Malibu beach house was being destroyed while I was 5,000 miles away in London. I had leased the house for the months I would be doing Misery to Doty Fayed, the firstborn son of an Egyptian billionaire and the owner of Harrods in London, later to become famous as Princess Diana's beau. He liked my property because there was a guest house for his maid. I was encouraged by that information. I thought a live-in maid would keep it spotless. Doty had a girlfriend he hooked up with in California who moved into my house with her large German shepherds, despite his having signed my contract stipulating that no pets were allowed in the house. The untrained 100-pound dogs urinated all over the interior, shredded the retro fabrics on my furniture, and scratched the wooden floors. The Berber carpeting became flea-infested. My rose garden was trampled completely flat. There were food stains and spills that were never cleaned up. Dodie's father sent me a check to repair the damages, but it still didn't cover the amount of time it took to make over the whole house. In a bizarre twist of fate, upon my arrival in London, I was asked to do another presentation for the royal family. This time I met Prince Charles and Princess Diana. Charles was handsome, genuine, and very charming. He leaned in to whisper in my left ear, "I'm a great fan of yours." That made my night. Diana was very shy and reserved that evening, leaving a lot of distance between her and Charles, keeping her eyes lowered. I could see that her skin was broken out under her makeup. She smiled and took my hand and said, "Thank you for making the trip here." I said, "You are very loved in my country, Your Royal Highness. I hope you know that." It was the last time Charles and Diana appeared together in public. The next morning, the Prime Minister announced their separation. Ironically, Diana's new controversial relationship would be with the man who had laid waste to my Malibu home. Following Dodie's death, a reporter from the Los Angeles Times called me. It had leaked through the tabloids that Dodie had once rented my house. The reporter wanted to know if I had any comments about Dodie. I answered yes, he was an absolute pig. The reporter was speechless. I guess she expected some charming story of princely chivalry. "He did everything but roast a goat in my living room." I was hoping they would print my quote, but they didn't. When I returned to Los Angeles after misery had closed, Barney had mellowed and was sympathetic as I slumped back into a dark mood that I couldn't stop. Now I was both fat and depressed. I wanted to smoke and drink and have a TV show to do. Barney sat across the table from me. He wanted me to feel good about myself once more. "I understand," Barney said. "I'd like to send you to a spa in San Diego where they can help you lose weight. What do you say to that?" I agreed. I threw myself on the mercy of the spa's weight loss coaches and left a month later 20 pounds lighter. Ready or not, CBS was throwing a black tie gala for their super executive Jeff Sagansky, and we had received our engraved invitation. Never mind that it was on the same day as my birthday. "What's the big fucking deal?" I shouted over my hairdryer when Barney notified me that we were running late. "It's not like we have a show on CBS's fall schedule." A limo delivered us to Rex, a trendy downtown L.A. restaurant that CBS had taken over for the Sagansky event. Outside the front door was an easel set up with a large photo of Jeff Sagansky, but the expected gaggle of paparazzi for an event of this magnitude was nowhere in sight. We walked inside. Many beautiful tables had been set up with black and white place settings and engraved menus at each chair. Hundreds of black and white balloons bobbed around in the silent room near the second-story catwalk. But there were no people. Barney and I were alone in the huge dining room. Suddenly, the catwalk was filled with over 100 people, all singing, "Happy Birthday!" to me. Barney had managed to pull off a phenomenal surprise 50th birthday party for me. Friends from every series I had ever done were there, along with old friends from my boarding school days and people connected to Misery who'd flown in from London. The whole CBS celebration was a ruse, elaborately conceived by Barney. Along with the ironic twist, executive Jeff Sagansky was there to honor me instead of the other way around. I had done a made-for-TV movie called Hard Hat and Legs about a decade before, and the famous musician and singer Bobby Short had been featured in it. He had flown in with his three-piece band at Barney's request and entertained all night. Barney's daughter Tori had filmed birthday hellos from so many people that I love and admire. Johnny Mathis had always been my teenage crush. There he was, on film, singing Happy Birthday to me, a cappella. My good friend Barry Manilow appeared on the tape next, sitting at his piano saying, "So, Sharon, I hear Mathis sang Happy Birthday to you. Well, fuck him. Here you go.
Then he sang his version. It was perfect. It was such a fun night. I was overwhelmed with love from all my friends and my family. The next morning, we woke up at my newly refurbished Malibu beach house. On the flagpole outside my glass balcony doors was a flag printed with, "Happy birthday, Sharon!" Barney was already up. "You better get up and get dressed. Everyone's coming over for a barbecue today." All the friends who had come in from out of town and my family and Barney's family came over for the day. A photographer from London, Judith Hull, had been flown in to photograph me at age 50 on the Malibu dunes I loved so much. I looked very content and poised in the photos. It must have been the leftover glow of the career success of my 30s and 40s. The froth of the crashing ocean is the backdrop for many of the photos. It suited how washed up my television career would become for the next decade. "40. Get off my ass." I wasn't ready to return. It had been 7 years since the series had ended. Now there was to be a movie, Cagney and Lacey, The Return. Barney had made an agreement with Jeff Sagansky to produce 4 made-for-TV movies for CBS, with Tyne and me reprising the roles of Mary Beth Lacey and Christine Cagney. I read the first script. Then I rebelled. Christine Cagney was now a lieutenant, but she was working at a supervisory desk job for the district attorney. She was living in an elegant brownstone and was married to a wealthy man. Desk job? Married? All I could think was, Jesus, is this what sobriety did to Christine? She lost her mind? She'd hitting the bottle again? I had played the character for 6 seasons, 119 episodes. I knew her better than I knew myself. There was no way Christine would settle for working a desk position, even on her way to her dream job of being the first female police commissioner. Especially unbelievable was that she would now be married and living this piss-elegant life. The script I read opened with Christine throwing a fancy party in her home. She's wearing a long string of pearls. Pearls? I don't think so. I'm surprised she didn't hang herself with them. I almost left Barney over this one. He stood by his writers. Barney tried to defend the idea of a now-married Cagney. I was not convinced. In fact, I was appalled. "I didn't say she'd stay married," Barney told me. "And it's not like she's married to just anyone. I got James Naughton to play your husband." Well, no offense to the mega-talented, Tony-winning James Naughton, with whom I had co-starred 20 years earlier in my first TV series, Faraday and Company. But I was adamant that Christine Cagney would never tie the knot, at least not while she had career goals to pursue. The fans agreed with me. By the second movie, Christine was divorced. I filmed the first movie with the worst perm ever put on a human head. Combine that with the fact that I was still 20 pounds overweight. The camera was not my friend. Tyne had put on a few pounds over the previous 5 years, too. I don't know who nicknamed the quad of movies Cagney and Lacey the menopause years, but I wouldn't want to tune in for that. I was living it. But apparently the fans had a different view. They showed up for us in record numbers. The first reunion movie swept the ratings for the entire night and came in second as the highest-rated television movie of the year. A huge, well-promoted boxing match between 45-year-old George Foreman and heavyweight boxer Michael Moorer was on the same night and at the same time. But we still prevailed. CBS sent lots of flowers. They were in love with us again. The next day, Jay Leno's opening monologue for The Tonight Show contained the following joke, leading the audience to think he was talking about the aging, overweight Foreman and his out-of-shape opponent. "So, everybody, how about those numbers?"
I guess it goes to show that it doesn't matter how old or fat you are, you can still land a hit. But enough about Cagney and Lacey. Hopefully, Jay's wife Mavis kicked his fat ass that night. Journalists, most of them male, reviewing the movies went crazy writing about my size. One Pulitzer Prize-winning reviewer with the Los Angeles Times wrote that my backside looked like a sack of potatoes. Years later, he apologized. I asked Barney why the media was so focused on and so cruel about my weight. He said, because you were the blonde. You broke their heart. They'll never forgive you. Could it be that the public was that shallow in 1994? Or was it more that Barney himself couldn't forgive me? Even though our first movie scored the highest in the Nielsen ratings, it didn't seem to matter to the new president and head of programming for CBS, Leslie Moonves. I had known Leslie since we were both young acting students in class together. To me, he was just another kid hoping to be an actor. In his position as CBS president, Les decided he was going to shake it all up and attract an audience of younger viewers in the way that the Fox Network was doing at the time. And the way to attract younger viewers was to air shows starring beautiful younger actresses. He wasn't at all interested in grown-up female-centered dramas and comedies like Linda Bloodworth Thomason's Designing Women, though it remained a hit show. He told me that he'd always hated Cagney and Lacey and labeled its major success a fluke. He killed the franchise. Ironically, his inappropriate treatment of actresses, as well as female writers, producers, and assistants, led to his eventual demise at CBS and in the industry. Tyne, Barney, and I had to do most of our own promoting of the last two movies, which were shuffled into impossible time slots and intentionally buried by Moonves. CBS might have forgotten about Cagney and Lacey, but women had not. In April 1995, Tyne and I were invited to join actresses Whoopi Goldberg, Lee Grant, Valerie Harper, and political activists like Bella Abzug, Betty Friedan, and Gloria Steinem on stage in a rally for women's equality sponsored by the National Organization for Women. Hundreds of thousands of women and a few men, including Barney, filled the National Mall in Washington, D.C., under the shadow of the Washington Monument. Tyne and I received a lengthy ovation. Looking out at the huge crowd, it was the first time that I completely grasped how Cagney and Lacey had represented the pulse of the future, a marker on the timeline of feminist and women's history. That's the thing about history. You don't know you're making it when you're in progress. But if it's good, the ripple effect goes on and on. Even though I was in my 50s, I was still trying to figure out who I was becoming as an actress. One morning, I received a phone call with an offer to play the lead role of Jenny in Neil Simon's Chapter 2 at the Gielgud Theatre in London's West End. I would play opposite the very sexy Scottish actor Tom Conti. As popular as Neil Simon's plays had been for decades in the United States, they were very rarely produced across the pond. It made me nervous, but I wanted to accept the challenge. After all, being the female lead in a Neil Simon play and working with Tom Conti? How good is that? Barney had found an apartment we both loved on Fisher Island, and ready to escape the show business view of Los Angeles, he happily sold his Hancock Park property and produced a renovation and move for the two of us to the placid small island off Miami's shore. I kept my Studio City cottage. As long as I still had a home in Los Angeles, I was fine being a bi-coastal citizen. As he headed to sun and ocean views, I memorized my lines and reconnected with the narrow and foggy streets of London. Early on during the Chapter 2 rehearsals, the director had a complaint. It was during Jenny's famous monologue, and I was giving it all I had. He stopped me in the middle of it. "Keep your arms down. All you American actors flail your arms around too much," he said. During your long monologue, just sit down on the chaise and tell me honestly how you feel. I followed his direction. I sat down. It was more intimate, but it was far less emotional. One night, after we had opened, unbeknownst to the cast, Neil Simon was in the audience. It wasn't one of my better shows. The audience didn't seem to be responding the way they usually did. Neil came backstage after the show to say hello to the actors. He was very cordial and warm, shaking our hands and repeatedly saying, "Great job." When he said it to me, I knew better. It was clear to me that he had things to say about the performers, but he wouldn't speak his opinion with others nearby. Neil was harboring a complaint. I wanted to know what it was. Very conversationally, I asked, "So, Neil, where are you staying?" The next morning at 9 a.m., on the dot, I phoned him at his hotel. When he answered, I dove right in. "Neil, there's something I'm not doing right. I don't know what it is. Please tell me." He plainly said, "Get off your ass! Get on your feet when you do that monologue. In the 70s, when Chapter 2 premiered, that monologue would get an ovation. Every performance. It won't anymore. But get on your feet when you deliver that monologue." I thanked him profusely. That night, Neil returned to see the show again. I did the monologue exactly as he had advised, and the audience responded with spontaneous applause. By the time I got off the stage into my dressing room, Neil was there. He was so happy that he lifted me off my feet and spun me around. And that took some serious strength. Tom Conti and I still stay in touch, and recently he told me a story of our time on stage together that he swears is true. Close to the end of the play, my character is drunk and in a big fight with her husband George. The line as written, my character feigning a southern accent, says, "I'm just a dumb old country girl from Cleveland, George." Tom recalls that one night on stage, I said, "I'm just a dumb old cunt, George." He said, "You're a what?" I said, "I'm a cunt." Backstage, following the curtain call, I asked Tom, "Did I just say the word cunt on a West End stage?" He responded, "Twice." That's how Tom Conti tells the story. I deny everything.